You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to episode 34 of the Untaming podcast. I hope you found last week's interview with Dr. Jill Rapley on baby-led weaning as interesting as I did. It's almost hard to believe that seemingly unrelated things such as appetite control and the severing of the umbilical cord at birth have a connection to the introduction of solid foods. Next week's episode with anarchist writer Kevin Tucker will be the last one for the season. Kevin is the host of the Primal Anarchy podcast, and he had so much to say on heavy topics like white supremacy, indigenous hunter-gatherers, ayahuasca, the collapse of civilization, and some others that, as I did recently with Peter Michael Bauer's interview, I've decided to split his episode into two parts. As it is the end of the year, Anchor, my podcast host, gave me some statistics I had not seen before. What I found most surprising was that this year we have seen a 300% increase in our listeners in Singapore, an 88% increase in our listeners in Canada, and an 82% increase in our listenership in the United States. And we hit number 8 in the charts on Spotify in Cyprus. So welcome to all of our new listeners across the world. I hope you have found some value in the content. And if so, I would greatly appreciate some new reviews. I found today's episode with Dr. Jacqueline Wolf on the history of cesarean sections especially interesting. We talked about the weight of babies in pounds, so for a bit of reference for those of you more familiar with kilograms, 7 pounds is 3.1 kilograms, 10 pounds is 4.5 kilograms, 14 pounds is 6.3 kilograms, and 16 pounds is 7.2 kilograms. Now I should warn you, there is a graphic description of a birth that, while it is immensely fascinating, it may be difficult to hear, particularly if you have experienced a C-section yourself. Sixty-nine-year-old Jacqueline Wolf was born and grew up in Chicago and currently lives in Athens, Ohio. She has a grown daughter, Cora, and a 16-month-old grandson. Jackie is a professor in the Department of Social Medicine at Ohio University. She is a historian of medicine with teaching expertise in the history of women's and children's health, the history of public health, and the history of biomedical ethics. Her research focuses on the history of birth and breastfeeding practices in the United States and is primarily concerned with the long-term impact that specific medical recommendations and practices have on public health. She is the author of three books, Don't Kill Your Baby, Public Health and the Decline of Breastfeeding in the 19th and 20th Centuries, Deliver Me from Pain, Anesthesia and Birth in America, and Cesarean Section, An American History of Risk, Technology, and Consequence. She also has a podcast, Lifespan, Stories of Illness, Accident, and Recovery, that talks about encounters with the healthcare system and contains stories bound by a common theme, a person's personal journey through a particular type of medical trauma. Last night she had 8 hours of sleep, and for dinner tonight she had chicken and beet green stir fry with potatoes. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I first heard about you through Jennifer Grayson's podcast, Uncivilized. Jennifer was also a guest on this show last year, and I've since listened to your own podcast, Lifespan, which covers such a wide range of topics related to health. I think the last one I heard was the one on alcoholism. But anyway, I digress. You're quite the wealth of knowledge, and there are so many topics we could talk about. I really want to get into the history of C-sections and home birth in America. So to start with, what was it that initially prompted you to start researching these areas?
Well, I have to say it was the birth of my daughter. When I was in graduate school, I was really studying to be an environmental historian, which is a fairly new field where you study how humans affect landscapes over time. Mm-hmm. And after I had my daughter, I was tossing around for a dissertation topic, thinking I would write about the U.S. Dust Bowl drought and what contributed to that environmental disaster. And I realized I really have no affinity for environmental history. I'm not a particularly an outdoors person. And I, you know, I hadn't planned the big events of my life too well, because I gave birth to my only child in the middle of graduate school, which are two incredibly time consuming activities. Mm-hmm. And I literally, in despair, realizing that I didn't want to pursue the dissertation topic I thought I did, sitting at my feet was The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding, which is La Leche League's book that most women around the world have read. Most mm-hmm. breastfeeding mothers are familiar with that book. And it occurred to me I could write a dissertation about breastfeeding practices and how they've changed over time. And little did I know that that decision that came out of the blue turned me into a medical historian.
So then, how do you go about finding the historical records for these sort of things?
You know, that's such a wonderful question, because essentially the faculty in my department, especially the women in the department, ask me the same question, but in a much less nice way than you just asked it. They were kind of very put off by the topic and said that I would never find sources and that it was far too narrow and ridiculous a topic. Oh. And but on the other hand, it was the men who were U.S. historians who really thought it was incredibly interesting. Either they thought it was interesting or they kind of backed away from me in embarrassment because they didn't want to repeat the word breastfeeding. Yeah. But it turned out that to find sources, it was like going through the wrong end of a funnel. Rather than not being able to find sources, the more I found sources, the more they led to more and more and more and more sources. So that after a time, I just had to say I had to call a halt to it. And the kind of sources I used, I mean, my original question really was, at what point in U.S. history did women begin to turn away from breastfeeding and human milk and toward bottles and animal milk? So that was my central research question. And I frankly assumed I was going to be writing a dissertation about post-World War II America, thinking that that was when it occurred. And I kept going back in time and back in time and back in time and realized it really happened in the last quarter of the 19th century, between 1875 and 1900. And so the sources were fascinating. I used visiting nurse records. I used all kinds of demographic records, because the death rate from diarrhea was so high of infants. 13% of infants in the U.S. died in 1900, and more than half of them died of diarrhea. And breastfed babies do not die of diarrhea. So then I got into questions about the state of cow's milk and why. I mean, these days, formula feeding, in at least in the developed world, in wealthy countries, you don't think of it as something that's going to kill babies, because it's pasteurized and milks and water supplies are chemically treated and filtered. So then the question became questions of cow's milk and the state of cow's milk. Anyway, I ended up with so many research questions and how formula came to be, that it ended up being a dissertation more about the early 20th century than the mid-20th century.
Huh. And so then when did you start researching birth? How did that interrelate there?
Well, I became, by then I was pretty well known as someone who was becoming an expert in women's reproductive health. And I was asked to do a course for the history department, and which I called History of Women's Health and Medicine in the United States. And I had a couple weeks devoted in the class. It was a semester-long class, a couple weeks devoted to the class on childbirth. And I began the class with a physiological description of what birth feels like to most women. And You know, I came of age during the heyday of natural childbirth in the U.S. There was a huge women's health reform movement. And one of the biggest emphases of that movement was to kind of wrest women's health care away from paternalistic male physicians. That was the rhetoric of that day. Mm-hmm. And natural childbirth was considered one way for women to exemplify how powerful they were. So natural childbirth, meaning childbirth without medical interference that was unnecessary, because births were heavily drugged in the U.S., beginning in about the 1930s and through the mid-1970s. I mean, really heavily drugged. Women would come in labor and be sedated until they were wheeled into the delivery room when they were given general anesthesia. So most women were, you know, doctors described obstetrics as being about treatment of drug confusion. Literally, that's what they would say. So natural childbirth was a real pushback against that kind of heavy medicalization of birth. Mm. And what stunned me, and this is what got me interested in childbirth, as I'm describing to this class of young women, now this is the late 1990s, describing to this class of young women about what childbirth feels like, instead of, you know, this keen interest and excitement, reflected back at me were a bunch of horrified faces. And one young woman raised her hand and said, "I want my epidural in the hospital parking lot. I don't want to feel anything about birth." So that got me interested in the research question is, what on earth happened between the 1970s and, you know, at the start of the 21st century that made women turn away from natural birth and even ridicule it? So that was the subject of my second book, which is A History of Obstetric Anesthesia, and how views of labor pain have changed over time. So that's how I got interested in childbirth. It was more about the social aspects of childbirth and the kind of attitudes that physicians and women bring into the birthing chamber.
Huh. Okay, so going to like the more like the older history of birth. So prior to the first recorded C-section, which I want to get into soon, what sort of time period are we looking at when cesareans were being performed?
Well, I mean, there's records of cesareans in early modern history. Mm-hmm. But most of those were done more for, I mean, and this is only from, I haven't done this research personally, but I've heard other historians talk about it. Much of that was done not for medical reason at all, but to ensure lines of inheritance, that if a mother died in childbirth, for example, if you got the baby out of the womb alive, then you could guarantee a line of inheritance through that child. So that was one of the reasons, you know, in what we would call ancient history. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the era that we think of, you know, there's the first record, and it wasn't the first cesarean in the U.S. by any means, but it was the first one written up in a medical journal, was in 1827. And this is before obstetric anesthesia. Ether wasn't discovered until 1847. So that's a full 20 years before you had any way to quell surgical pain. So those kind of cesareans were only performed as a very desperate effort to save a mother's life. And because the majority of women died from cesareans, because you had high infection rates, you had enormous blood loss, and no way to treat either hemorrhage or infection, no cures at all, doctors avoided cesareans at every possible cost.
Right. And so I understand a lot of those early ones were done on slave women. So why was that?
Well, first of all, slave women had no voice. All the records show if they were performed on white women, there was discussion and women gave very clear consent. Slave women had obviously no voice whatsoever. And the only one who would consent would be the owner, the slave owner. And if a mother was not doing well in childbirth, you know, this was... slaves were considered chattel; they were property. So, what value was a woman? And again, I'm talking like a slave owner might have thought. What value was a woman who wasn't doing well in childbirth, but her baby might be worth something? So just ordered the doctor to try to save that infant and just cut the baby out of the uterus. So that's my guess. I mean, there's no records of the way slave owners thought. This is just my historical guess. But it happened enough. So we have very, very good detailed records of all the cesareans performed in the U.S. between roughly the beginning of the 19th century, so around 1800 through 1871. We have a record of every single one, where it was performed, who it was performed on, what the outcome was, who the doctor was, mainly because there was a medical statistician who became obsessed with gathering data about cesarean sections. And so his records are actually at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, and they are excellent. He was an excellent statistician. So I've looked at all of those records, and we know from those records that more than half of those women who gave birth by cesarean before 1871 were women of color, largely slaves, and almost all Black, a few who were recorded as mixed. There were a couple recorded as Mexican, but at that time in the United States, only between 12.5% and 14.5% of the population was Black, and yet more than half of those cesareans were performed on Black women.
Yeah, wow. So what sort of conditions were they in when these were being performed?
Well, they were, I mean, the main reason for that was recorded for cesarean sections in that era was pelvic malformation. And when I say that, I mean very severe pelvic malformation, usually caused by rickets, which is a softening of the bones in childhood. And we know now it's due to a lack of exposure to sunshine.
Yeah.
Because that's essentially, vitamin D is a misnomer. Vitamin D is actually a hormone, calciferol, that's produced by your body and it's triggered by sunlight. And that's what strengthens our bones. So rickets was a real problem in the 19th century, mainly because, especially in cities where there was a lot of pollution and sunshine was blocked from pollution, cities were so dangerous that a lot of mothers didn't let their children outside. In the South, I imagine that a lot of infants, probably especially the offspring of slaves, were, who knows how they were treated, who knows where they were housed, who knows how much sunshine they got. But apparently a lot of women grew up with rickets and had very severe pelvic malformation. So a lot of them did very poorly in childbirth for that reason. A big cause of having to have a cesarean was what the statistician recorded as dwarfism. Many of the women who were given those cesarean sections through 1871 were characterized as dwarfs, women under about four feet 6 inches tall, and they too had a really hard time giving birth and had to have cesareans. But again, more than half of these women didn't survive the surgery.
Yeah. So more than half of them didn't survive. What about the survival rate for the babies? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head, and I probably should have looked that up before you and I talked. Most of the time, I can say this. Most of the time, the surgery was done to save the life of the mother, and the babies were irrelevant. Doctors would say, for example, what the thinking was, and they were right. The thinking was that a motherless childless mother could almost always have more babies, but a motherless child was almost surely going to die, because if that baby couldn't be breastfed in that era, that was a death sentence.
Yeah.
So the thought was about saving the mother. So I can tell you the first recorded cesarean section in the U.S., the one that was written up in a medical journal in great detail, that baby ultimately had to be taken out of the mother's womb in literally in pieces. The doctor couldn't get, the baby was so large. The mother was obese. So my guess was that the baby was suffering from macrosomia, that some, the mother was probably diabetic during pregnancy. The baby grew so, as the doctor said, uncommonly large, that even with a cesarean section, they couldn't lift. And don't forget, she was not anesthetized. She was feeling every single thing. And she was really, and begged the doctor not, I mean, when the doctor tried to lift the baby out of her uterus, she began screaming, and he ended up cutting the baby up, the fetus up, and removing the baby in pieces. And there are records that that would have to happen often. So far fewer infants survive cesarean, to answer your question. I don't have the exact numbers, but far fewer survived than mothers survived.
Right. And where were they, where were these sort of cesareans being performed? Were they being performed at home or in some sort of like hospital unit or at a doctor's office?
Virtually 100% of the time in the woman's home.
Right. Wow.
And frankly, I mean, that wasn't a bad thing. Hospitals in that era in the United States were places only for the most desperate, poverty-stricken Americans. Yeah. They were places you went to die. People who could afford it could bring doctors into their home. It was the last place. This is before the germ theory of disease. It's the last place anyone would want to go for surgery, a hospital. Yeah. You would want to avoid that at all costs and certainly not give birth there.
Mm. Okay, so I want to go back to this first birth. What did you say it was, 1827?
1827.
Yeah. So you said the baby was very big. So how big would that be? Because I'm sure listeners are thinking maybe 10, 11 pounds, but...
No. Thank you for pushing me on that. What obstetric textbooks said at the time, they defined a baby that was too large to go through the birth canal as being over 14 pounds. So I cannot tell you, I cannot exaggerate enough what they would do to encourage a vaginal birth. That to perform a cesarean section, you had to have a baby that was, when they said uncommonly large, I mean, you know, we're not talking 10, 9 pounds, 11 pounds. The obstetric textbooks defined it as over 14 pounds. You're going to have to translate that into the metric system. I'm sorry, I'm an ignorant American, so we
often use pounds though as well for our baby, so it's kind of relevant.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. So the question. Oh, so and also another indication would be, and this is how extreme it was. Another indication might be some kind of tumor, either in the uterus or in the birth canal. But I'm talking football-sized tumor, not, you know, what you would think of as a, you know, just your, you know, 1 inch, 2 inch. Again, you're going to have to translate this for me into the metric system. Not, you know, what you would think of, or even, you know, even in millimeters, nothing like that. Football size. So we're talking, you know, a foot and a half. We're talking huge tumor. Even the textbooks would even say, and this is using 19th century horrific terminology, they would even say, quote, even a double monster can be born vaginally. Double monster meaning the 19th century term for a conjoined twin. A conjoined twin would be delivered vaginally. So I'm telling you, when I say that it would be only for the most extreme conditions that a cesarean section would be performed, I mean extreme in a way that we can't even imagine today.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So yeah, see, I've heard that you talk about this story before, about this woman's story, and I find it as fascinating as it is gruesome. Could you talk more about the events that led up to them while trying to first get the baby out naturally and then, could you tell us more of the story?
Yes, she was attended by two midwives. Mm-hmm. And that was the norm, that you know, doctors normally did not attend births. Two midwives were there. And only if midwives had extreme difficulty did they call in a physician. And in this case, they did. And, you know, it was really, everything about this story is extreme. They were in the, was in the middle of a huge storm, such a terrible storm that when the doctor tried to call in help for what he was seeing, flooding was so bad in that area that no one could come to help. And this is an era too. She was in a cabin that was not, you know, the draft from the storm and the rain from the storm was coming in between the logs and through the crevices in the cabin. And the wind was blowing so badly that the candles that was lighting the doctor, this is in the middle of the night, that was lighting the scene kept getting blown out, so that the midwives began to help the doctor by holding up a blanket in front of the candles to try to keep the candles from blowing out. Mm-hmm. The doctor was immediately annoyed with the midwives because they couldn't explain what was going on. They kept saying the pains, meaning the contractions, the pains seem very good, but nothing is happening. And sure enough, he checked and her cervix wasn't dilating at all, but she seemed to be in the throes of very strenuous labor. And, finally, after hours and hours of this agony and with the woman near death, he got the permission of the midwives and permission of the woman, and they all decided to perform this surgery. And again, as I described before, the baby was taken out in pieces. The woman did survive the surgery, which again was, you know, that was the minority of women in that era. And he went to visit her, and she apparently healed well and was up and walking within 4 to 6 weeks. And when he actually did a medical exam, he couldn't find any cervical opening. Now, as he said, and he kind of ended the report that way, the journal article that way, he said, if there was no cervical opening, how did she get pregnant in the first place? Because obviously the sperm is going to swim up through the cervical opening. Anyway, that's the way it ended. Hmm. Who knows what the story was? But that was his medical diagnosis, that she had essentially no opening to her cervix, which clearly there had to be some kind of opening or she never would have gotten pregnant in the first place. But that's the written record of that story.
So do you have any of your own personal theories there to the absent cervix?
I have a theory about why the baby was so large, which I already explained. I'm sure that the mother was morbidly obese, and the way the doctor described it, and most likely was severely diabetic, which creates, you know, incredibly large babies if unchecked, which is why we treat diabetes so seriously, including gestational diabetes during pregnancy. And of course, there was no knowledge of diabetes in that era. So that's why the baby became so huge. So I have that theory. But in terms of why the cervix wasn't opening at all, you'd have to ask a midwife or a physician. And I probably should have asked questions about it. I never have. So I have no idea.
Yeah, no, it's just so curious. So do you know if the mother went on to have any more children?
There's no, as far as I know, there is no record of that.
Yeah, okay. Was this then considered a success because the mother survived?
Absolutely. That's why it was written up in the medical journal, because you didn't write it up if it wasn't a success. I mean, this was a medical triumph, and this doctor wrote it up. He wrote it up as medical heroism. And it's, you know, that's why there's so many details. That's why I know so many details to the story, because he included every detail in this medical journal article, and it was considered a medical triumph.
Yeah. Now, so you were saying that there were records up until 1871 of all of the caesareans. But so what happened in 1871?
Oh, it's only because of this doctor who was the medical statistician. Mm-hmm. He took it upon himself, not just to gather the data that was published, but he took it upon himself to contact physicians all over the country to get data about every cesarean that was performed. He followed up. He checked to make sure it was accurate. I mean, that's why I think you can really trust his records, which are still all intact. Because he just took this extraordinary interest in it. And after 1871, he stopped gathering the data. And that's the only reason. It's not that anything happened. Yeah. It's just that this cesarean section fanatic just stopped gathering data.
Yeah. Okay. So when did when did Caesarean start to become more commonly used for things that aren't so urgent?
Well, they certainly became slightly safer after we understood what caused infection. So once we had acceptance of the germ theory of disease and doctors understood the incredible importance of sanitation, which midwives actually, that's why midwives had so much better birth outcomes than physicians, because midwives really did keep things clean, even without understanding what caused infection. Doctors thinking that they were above, you know, they weren't dirty. So they would go from sick person to sick person and never wash their hands, which, you know, became, and that's where childbed fever, so-called childbed fever, which we now call, I mean, that's postpartum infection. But childbed fever was caused largely by treatment from physicians as opposed to midwives. And actually, when birth moved to the hospital, there was a much higher maternal death rate than even in 1800 or even the mid 18th century, even in the 1750s, we know from midwives' diaries, they had much better outcomes than what occurred in American hospitals in the 1930s. And that's because hospitals are, that was the pre-antibiotic era. Hospitals, if you can't control infection, are a terrible place for women to give birth. Mm. So cesarean sections, so to answer your original question, began to become safer as soon as we understood what caused postpartum infection, but they truly didn't become safe. The cesarean section rate in the U.S. hovered between 2.5% and 4% until really the 1960s. And what turned it around was antibiotics, which weren't available to the civilian population until after World War II, because we could finally treat postpartum infection, and the ability to store and transfuse blood, which also didn't become available to the civilian population until after World War II. So the reason the maternal death rate, and really around the world, went down was really nothing to do with obstetric practice per se, but the fact that we could suddenly treat the two things that killed mothers, postpartum infection and hemorrhage. And those are still the biggest cause of maternal death today, but now they're treatable. So that suddenly made cesarean section far less dangerous. And after the ability to treat infection and hemorrhage, the cesarean section rate crept up to fractions of a percent to about 2.5%. And in some areas of the country, some areas of the U.S., as much as 4%, simply because the most serious side effects of C-sections could be treated.
Right. So this 2.5% to 4%, what sort of, what was happening that made them be like, okay, we have to do a C-section? Like what were the problems, I guess?
Well, still it was, you know, what's interesting is that the definition of dystocia, which has changed radically since the late 1950s. Dystocia was the most common reason for a cesarean. Dystocia meaning a blocked labor. And right. I kind of describe the extreme conditions for you of a blocked labor. And those didn't change particularly radically. Because doctors, again, they were trained up until World War II. They were trained to do every single trick in the book to avoid a cesarean section. And doctors were very adept at using forceps in that era. So if a baby was stuck, they knew how to place forceps and pull the baby out. That skill is almost completely lost for many reasons now. But, okay, I just lost my train of thought again. So the reasons for cesareans in that era, again, they would be pretty extreme because doctors were really skilled. They were skilled at breech birth, which is, you know, normally babies deliver head first, and that's what you hope for. But there are, you know, about 5%, it depends, between 1 and 5% of babies often present breech, meaning either foot first, which can be, you know, very problematic, or butt first, you know, presenting with their behinds first, which is much easier to deliver than feet first. Or a baby, if they're sideways, that would require a cesarean section.
Yeah.
If there was placenta previa meaning the placenta covers all or part of the cervical opening. Often placenta previa resolves itself, so the placenta begins to move away from the cervical opening throughout the pregnancy. But if it doesn't, that would require a cesarean section. So again, pretty extreme conditions that would cause, you know, if you have a serious placenta previa and don't do a cesarean section, the mother will begin to bleed and can die. So again, pretty serious conditions would lead, you know, again, the transverse lie, the baby lying sideways, but most breech births, doctors knew how to deliver the baby, and that wouldn't cause a cesarean. So it would have to be something pretty extreme, very extreme case of dystocia, meaning block labor, or something wrong with the placenta, like placenta previa, or a transverse lie of the fetus, something extreme like that.
So, yeah, I want to hear more about these skills and practices of the original midwives, I guess, in those days, because you mentioned cleanliness, but also you said every trick in the book to avoid a C-section. What were these tricks that, you know, have all but been forgotten today?
Well, most of them are pretty simple. For example, one of the most frightening complications of birth, even today, is something called shoulder dystocia, which is after the head is delivered, the shoulders get stuck in the birth canal, and that's an extreme medical emergency. And midwives, you know, a very simple trick, which midwives today, it's been kind of reinstated for midwives, is to get the mother to get up on all fours. And it widens the birth canal just slightly enough that the baby then the shoulders will slip out. So that's, you know, that's one. You know, midwives, basically, they didn't do too much to interfere. They would have women walk around during labor, which encourages labor. They would bring birthing stools with them so that women could give birth sitting up as opposed to lying down. You know, lying down, you're fighting gravity. Sitting up, you're not. So, you know, a lot of very simple things. But, you know, they were just really good at doing things like massaging the perineum to ease the baby out. You know, they were there to take their time. And, you know, for doctors, you know, it was almost scandalous for a male doctor to even enter the birthing chamber, let alone do something like massage the perineum. You know, male doctors, when they were learning, if they even learned in medical school how to give birth, you know, they would have to put a heavy blanket over the woman, and they wouldn't be allowed to see the baby. They would have to actually learn by feeling, because it was considered improper for them to, you know, even gaze at a woman who was half naked. And the stories are, one of the biggest scandals in the 1920s in the U.S. was the lack of training in medical school for birth. And one of my favorite stories of a doctor was being called to a birth after getting his medical degree, never having attended a birth. And he walks into the woman's home and he quickly determines that there is a large tumor blocking the birth canal and says to himself, the only thing I can do for this woman is to be here when she dies. And it turns out the baby was born no problem. And it turns out he thought the baby was a tumor.
Oh my
that
goodness.
He knew so little about birth that he was horrified by this thing in the birth canal and assumed that it was blocked labor and had no idea what to do. It was just the baby. So those were the kind of stories you heard about doctors' ignorance at the time. Now, the reason midwives began to call doctors in were for things like surgery, like the cesarean section, because they couldn't perform surgery. Doctors could. Doctors were trained in surgery. But also, by law, midwives could not use forceps. So once doctors could put forceps in their medical bag, they could be called in to be able to use forceps to try to get a stuck baby out of the birth canal. That was another reason to call in doctors.
I see. Okay. So now what caused the shift from home birth as the norm to hospital birth as the norm and from midwives to doctors?
Well, I'm sure it's different in every country, but I can, you know, being a U.S. historian, I can tell you that the trajectory in this country. Obstetricians, much like pediatricians, these were two specialists who were not held in high regard. Pediatricians, as one example, were kind of thought of as, they were called baby doctors, a very, you know, a derisive term. But obstetricians, much the same way, too. They were, you know, they didn't do much, other doctors thought. All they do is sit around and wait. What kind of skill is that? So many of the early highly trained so-called obstetricians really were as good as midwives. They did have certain skills, and they had the same patients as midwives did. They knew that it was safer to wait and to encourage vaginal birth as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways that they were, you know, and they didn't have much professional respect. They didn't have much professional respect from their peers or from women, because women were still by and large calling in midwives. One of the ways they garnered professional respect was by coupling obstetrics with gynecology. And in the US, that happened in the 1930s when a study was done by the American Medical Association. And the recommendation was made to make those two specialties into one specialty, obstetrics and gynecology, and to ensure that all training hospitals had a department of obstetrics and gynecology. And that's when doctors began to be trained in hospitals, and that's when birth started moving to the hospital. So it was a matter of trying to garner respect for women's medicine. And then once that conjoined specialty was created and moved to the hospital, the practical matter became, well, if doctors are being trained in birth in the hospital, we need to start slowly moving birth to the hospital. So that's essentially that's the easiest way to tell the story.
So I think for someone who sees birth as a normal physiological process, well, it seems maybe obvious that as a society we began to put pathologized birth once it became common to birth in a hospital instead of at home. And I'm thinking specifically with what you said to like the capability of handling issues like breech and shoulder dystocia. Would you agree?
Well, I can say that there was no medical reason to move birth to the hospital. It was really a practical reason. And it was a matter of both medical acculturation, again, trying to garner respect for obstetrics, and just as a practical matter, once there were residencies set up in hospitals, then it became the logical place to begin to encourage women to go to hospitals. But as I said, the maternal death rate in the United States went up markedly as birth began to move to the hospital. And we had a significantly higher maternal death rate in 1930 than we did in 1780, according to all medical records. And it was because of this move to the hospital. At the time, the hospital birth was not, there was no separate maternity floor at all. So women were basically commingled with sick people. So you can imagine the problems that caused for laboring women.
Yeah. So when the maternal mortality went up in the 1930s with the hospital births compared to in the 1700s, why did people not, you know, decide to revert back to birthing at home? Why did they still continue on?
You know, well, first of all, at least in the US, we didn't have very good vital statistics. So probably not enough attention was being paid. There was never any discussion about reverting back to home birth. I don't think the kind of discussion that did go on was we need to start separating maternal cases from the rest of the hospital. So there became a movement rather than going back to the home birth, the movement became we need to either start having hospitals devoted only to maternal care or sections of hospitals devoted only to maternal care. And that's where you started seeing what medical journal articles and obstetricians began to write about. We need to begin isolating mothers in hospitals. And that's the direction that it went in, as opposed to going back to home birth.
Okay, so having had, you know, two children myself, I have a little bit of understanding how pregnancy has been pathologized, which I'd like to ask you about. But then on your podcast, you pointed out that now conception has become pathologized too. So could you talk some more about this pathologizing of conception and pregnancy?
Well, I mean, I learned this one from my daughter. You know, when she, let's see, this is 2020. She gave birth in the summer in June of 2019. And she had never, you know, she grew up hearing me talk about my research. And she never expressed much interest. In fact, she just, you know, almost literally would put her finger in her ears and say, "Mom, I don't want to hear about that." So when she became pregnant, I really resolved that I wasn't going to foist anything on her unless she asked for my advice. And when she decided that she was going to become pregnant, and she does not mind me talking about this, she has talked about this on her podcast, I'm not violating any confidence here. When she decided that she and her husband were ready to have a family, she went to her gynecologist to have her IUD removed. And she was very excited about it. She liked this doctor a lot. She felt like she had a real rapport with her. And the doctor responded to her news that she was ready to have a family and she wanted the IUD removed by giving her a series of instructions. She, rather than, you know, Cora was so ready to celebrate with this doctor saying, oh, that she was expecting the doctor to say, "Oh, that's wonderful. It's so exciting." Nothing like that. The doctor said to her, "Okay, if you want me to remove your IUD, first of all, you have to be on prenatal vitamins for 4 months, meaning that you and your husband will have to use condoms. You have to have protected sex because you can't get pregnant before 4 months without making sure you're taking prenatal vitamins for 4 months. Number two, we need to do a complete blood work on you. We need to do prenatal testing to make sure you don't have any genes that could be problematic for your child. And if any genes show up in your genetic workup, then we're going to have to get any so-called bad genes. Then we're going to have to do a full genetic workup on your husband, too. And if his bad genes match with your bad genes, then you're going to have to do in vitro fertilization." So here is my robustly healthy 27-year-old daughter, very excited about the thought of being pregnant and being a new mother, not celebrating at all with this doctor who she had liked, but the doctor suddenly making her think that she has to consider in vitro fertilization before she even attempts to get pregnant. So she calls me from the car after this appointment and after they'd already drawn the blood for the genetic workup. And I couldn't even understand what she was saying because she was crying. And finally, I get this story out of her, which I just told you. And she says to me, "Do I really have to do all this?" I mean, and the last thing she wanted to do was wait 4 months to begin trying. I mean, she was all ready to start trying. "Do I have to do all this?" And okay, so this was the first time she was asking my advice about this. And I said to her one sentence. I said to her, "The only thing you have to do is find another doctor." And that's how I learned that certainly not all doctors, because I have told this story to other obstetricians since then. In fact, I told it to an audience of obstetricians in Minneapolis when I was asked to speak there. And the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Minnesota stood up in that audience after I told that story. And he said, "If any doctor in my practice did that, I would fire them that day. They would lose their jobs that day." So it's certainly not universal practice. But the whole ability now to do genetic testing non-invasively so that we can just do a simple blood test, now that we know that fetal DNA circulates in the mother's blood supply, we're able to do these non-invasive blood tests to do a genetic workup on the fetus. I fear that more and more doctors will begin to do what this doctor did to my daughter.
Yeah. And then what about the pathologizing during pregnancy?
Well, I mean, that the culture of pregnancy has changed. The experience of pregnancy has changed so much with things like ultrasound, for example. The fact that we can actually see a developing fetus as it develops has changed everything about pregnancy. It's changed how women are viewed in childbirth. Here I just described the cesarean section used to be about saving the mother. Now it's all about the focus on the fetus during labor, the fetus during labor. With at least in the United States, which is why in the US we have by far the highest maternal death rate of any wealthy country. No other wealthy country comes close to our maternal death rate. Because so much of the focus is on the fetus. And, you know, a lot of that is because of things like ultrasound, when you can actually see the fetus in the womb and people, you know, carry this photograph of their developing fetus around with them as you do any of your children. So it's really changed everything about pregnancy. And also, you know, I mean, after what my daughter went through, and she describes this on the podcast I did with her as well, she was ultrasounded to death. And this is, you know, what's happening to a lot of women. Mm. And I mean that figuratively, of course, not literally. But, you know, at one point, she knew she was carrying a little boy. And at one point, it was noticed that the kidneys were a little backed up. And it was explained to her that this often happens with male fetuses. Nothing to worry about once their kidneys are more well developed, but we really should have a deeper ultrasound to look at that. So of course she's immediately terribly nervous and has to go for this, you know, heavy duty ultrasound, and then had to have a follow-up ultrasound. And then it turned out the kidneys did resolve exactly as predicted, but the person who did the heavy duty, you know, 4D ultrasound noticed that her cervix appeared to be short, and he said, that could mean premature birth. Now we have to monitor your cervix. And it turned out the cervix resolved too. And the thing is, these are things we've never been able to see before. And even with ultrasound, that has been, even though ultrasound has been around for, you know, a good 50 years, it's also been perfected over time. The original ultrasounds, you could barely see anything. And now, you know, they've become almost like you're looking at a photograph. But the truth is, we don't know very much about how the cervix behaves during labor because we could never see it before. We don't know very much about male fetuses' kidneys during labor because we've never been able to see that before. So we jump to these conclusions. So my daughter had a totally healthy, normal pregnancy that she was scared to death throughout because they kept on coming up with diagnoses that turned out not to be true, but had to be monitored. And nothing turned out to be a problem. And yet she was terrified throughout the pregnancy that something was wrong because she kept being told that something might be wrong.
It's so not good for her stress levels.
Right. No. Right. So you can imagine what women go through when something really is wrong. Yeah. So even with a, you know, completely normal pregnancy, women are at some point they end up being frightened because of the kind of diagnostic tools that we have available today.
Mm. So now, like you've said, everything that you've gone through is obviously the history in America. Do you have any insight into how comparable this is in other countries around the world, like specifically the dates for the cesareans and the switch to hospital births and things like that?
Well, I can tell you about cesareans because that's what I've looked at the most closely. The United States led every other country by a good 20 years in terms of the cesarean section rate going up. No other country was close to us. By 20 years, I'm talking about from the late 1960s in the U.S. when the cesarean section rate began to spike enormously, a really steep increase very, very rapidly. That began to start in the late 1960s. And it wasn't until the late 1980s that you saw that increase in other wealthy countries. Since then, a few other countries have surpassed the U.S. We still have among the highest among wealthy countries. We're at 33%. One in three American women give birth by major abdominal surgery today. Other wealthy countries, it hovers more between 20 and 25%. Countries, Scandinavian countries, more like 16, 15%. But the countries that have surpassed us, Brazil has far surpassed us. They have private hospitals in Brazil where they only do surgical birth. The doctors, obstetricians, have never even attended a vaginal birth. Mm-hmm. Even in their public hospitals, their cesarean rate is about 40%. It's more like 80% in private hospitals in Brazil. China's rate, which is starting to go down, has been about 50% for about the last decade. Mexico's is very high. So there are countries that lay people would find surprising that have actually surpassed the U.S. for surgical births.
See, most people I know who, at least the people I know who have had C-sections, they've been told that they were necessary to save their life or their baby's life, that sort of thing. It was an emergency. It had to happen. But then I think of these rates where, when you said earlier on, 2.5 to 4% was what was done for quite a long time. But now it's at 33%. So there are definitely a lot of C-sections now being performed that aren't as needed as we are told. Is that right?
Well, I can say that unequivocally. And and even obstetricians, professional organizations all agree the cesarean section rate, certainly in the U.S., is way, way too high. Think about it. If 1 in 3 human births were that problematic, we would have died out as a species. I mean, there is, you know, any animal that has that many offspring, either mothers of reproductive age or infants not making it through birth, you know, that's not going to be a successful species. So my central research question became then, when I did the cesarean section book, so what in the culture at large, or what in the medical culture, caused this spike in cesarean births? And to give you the short answer, I mean, it's a very complicated story, much more complicated than I ever would have guessed until I did the research. But the number one reason was the introduction of the electronic fetal monitor, which was introduced in the United States in 1969. And again, much like the story I told about ultrasound, that until we could actually see a developing fetus, we didn't know what a male fetus's kidneys looked like or whether or not the urine backed up during fetal development. You know, we had no idea. Was that normal? Was that just like we had no way of monitoring the fetal heart rate continually throughout labor. There were fetal stethoscopes and nurses and physicians would use them about every half hour during labor just to check on the fetal heartbeat. But this continual monitoring, we didn't know how the fetus reacted to contractions. We didn't know how the fetal heartbeat reacted to contractions as contractions got more intense, or what the fetal heartbeat was like as it went through the birth canal. We didn't know that until we had the electronic fetal monitor. And what happened, the inventor of the monitor, who was an obstetrician at Yale University in the United States, he never intended the monitor to be used universally. He assumed it would be used only in high-risk births. But it was quickly used universally because the thought was, what could be the harm? If you can continually monitor the fetus, then we could rescue fetuses that are in serious stress. We could save babies from, we could wipe out stillbirth. We could wipe out cerebral palsy. And no one bothered to test the monitor. No one did any randomized control testing of the monitor. And by randomized control testing, I mean, you know, when you introduce something new in medicine, what you should do and what is usually done now is you want to compare that new instrument to the old standard of care. So what should have been done is women should have been randomized to either have the fetal heartbeat listened to with the fetal stethoscope, like it had been done for decades and decades, or use this new technology and then compare the outcomes. Well, when that was finally done, which wasn't until 8 years after the introduction of the monitor and after it had been accepted and introduced at all the hospitals, when that testing was finally done, they realized there was no difference in outcomes. The electronic fetal monitor did not bring down the rate of stillbirth, did not bring down the rate of cerebral palsy at all, ever, still has not, because now we know cerebral palsy really occurs early in fetal development, not as the result of a birth accident. It didn't bring down admissions to the neonatal intensive care unit. It didn't The only thing it did was increase the cesarean section rate. Because what happened was the doctors began to misread the monitor strip and assume that the heart was in distress and the baby had to get out of there. And the famous quote from the inventor of the fetal monitor was that his colleagues around the country were, this is his quote, dropping the knife with each drop in the fetal heart rate. And that's when you saw the cesarean section rate in the U.S. spike 455% between 1969 and 1987.
Wow. So now, knowing this, is this widespread enough that it's making any sort of like reduction in the rate?
No. Mm-hmm. No. And one of the things, the effect of the fetal monitor and the effect of ultrasound has been so profound for so many reasons, not just for what I just described in the cesarean section rate. It's also led to what I termed in my book, the de-skilling of obstetricians. Once you rely on ultrasound to see a fetus, as opposed to use your hands to be able to tell, is the fetus presenting head first? Is the fetus breech? How large is the fetus? We have now two generations of obstetricians who aren't trained anymore. They rely on their machines. They're not trained anymore in the hands-on skills. They don't know how to do breech births. They don't use forceps anymore. So it's contributed to the de-skilling of obstetricians. One of the solutions I think that are necessary in the United States is that midwives need to be involved in the training of obstetricians, because midwives, even now, they're the experts in vaginal birth. You know, we didn't really get a chance to talk much about the effect of the conjoining of obstetrics and gynecology, but gynecology is and always has been a surgical specialty. And by conjoining those specialties, it turned obstetricians into surgeons. And obstetrics is about physiology. Gynecology is about pathology. And, gynecologists always would treat tumors, they would treat vesicovaginal fistulas, which is when the urine would leak into the vagina, and they would be able to repair that surgically. But once you can join that specialty, the sensibility of the obstetrician, which used to be physiological, the gynecologist took over. And once you had them becoming surgeons, to this day, it's a surgical specialty, and any obstetric resident will tell you they're more comfortable. They'll all say it, and they all said it to me. I interviewed many of them. They're more comfortable doing C-sections than attending a vaginal birth. Now, this isn't true in all countries. I know in the countries, I'm thinking of the Netherlands especially. Even in the UK, the National Health Service is starting to encourage women to go back to home birth. In the Netherlands, though, midwives are the frontline providers. They're the ones who decide if it's a high-risk birth. Only then will they refer you to an obstetrician. Most births in the Netherlands occur at home, attended by a midwife. They have way better outcomes, both on the maternal side and the infant side, than in the U.S., for example. So, there's ample evidence that home birth is safe as long as you have a trained medical attendant there. And I really think that obstetrics in the U.S. would be improved vastly if all obstetric residencies had, as a rule, midwives on their faculty as well as obstetricians training residents.
So this... what you're saying with them being more confident with doing a C-section instead, is this because they have more experience with C-sections?
This is the interesting thing. And there still are obstetricians very interested in vaginal birth. I don't mean to say otherwise, but what many of them will say, and again, at this point in my research, I've interviewed hundreds of obstetricians of all generations, and what they will tell you is, a lot of the residents, they're interested in the problematic births, and for good reason. I mean, they want to learn how to treat problems, but the obstetricians who are interested in attending vaginal births, that they'll say, you know, the residents don't scrub in on my births because they don't think they have anything to learn from me. They want to scrub in on the births that are, that they think are complicated. They think those are the births that they can learn from. So yes, they're, you know, I had residents that I interviewed, you know, they would joke, you know, we joked to each other, they said, that we could do a cesarean section on a desert island, that, you know, they could do it in their sleep because that's what they, you know, that's their main training.
Yeah. So this, I guess we still think of like an OBGYN as, well, yeah, we think of it today, I mean, as an individual person. But do you think a separation of gynecology and obstetrics would be a vast improvement?
I think it would be an enormous improvement. The truth is, when these two specialties were conjoined, the only thing they had in common was that all their patients were women. And what an insult that is to women, to think that they could conjoin such different specialties and have that work. The thing is now, you know, it's such a natural thing to say, obstetrician, gynecologist, you know, obstetrician, gynecologist. In the U.S., we shorthand it by saying OB-GYN or OB-GYN, that it's, you know, and everyone knows what that means, both lay people and doctors. But it's funny, when I've mentioned this to obstetricians, to obstetrician gynecologists, they all agree with me. They all say, you know, and actually most of those doctors, you know, either enjoy obstetrics more than gynecology or enjoy gynecology more than obstetrics. But the truth is that all of them spend more time on gynecology than they do obstetrics. They all, when they're seeing women, it's more to treat routine gynecological issues than it is pregnant women.
Right. Huh. So I guess as we're kind of wrapping things up today, do you think there's anything blatantly missing that I haven't asked you about or that you'd like to share?
No, you did a great job of getting me to talk on my favorite topic. So
great. I'm glad you brought up the OBGYN. I almost forgot about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting, and people don't think about that enough. But I pinpointed that in my research as when birth became to be really pathologized. And again, it was partly the move to the hospital. And, you know, and think about it, you know, I haven't talked about it much from the women's perspective, but, you know, when you go to an unfamiliar place and when there's a lot of unfamiliar machinery and when you're being treated as a patient, you know, you begin to think about all the things that can go wrong. And hospitals are about things going wrong. And the truth is, and this is a great way to wrap it up, the real truth is the likelihood that everything will go right during birth is way, way greater than anything going wrong. And when things do go wrong, it's often because of medical interference, unnecessary medical interference.
Yeah. Oh, so true. That's a great way to end that. Yeah. I will put links in the show notes to your three books and to your podcast, Lifespan. Is there anywhere else you recommend the listeners going to find out more about what we've talked about today or to get in contact with you?
No, that would be, I do have an Amazon authors page.
Oh, yeah.
So you could link it to that too.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, Jackie, this has been a truly fascinating interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share your knowledge with us.
Well, you're very welcome, and I so appreciate the invitation.
So my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
It would be, always protect and nurture the most vulnerable.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.